I think that we need to make sure that the control of AI doesn't sit within, you know, two or three companies, right? Because if they put the regulations inside that nobody else can do the development of these models, then they're essentially going to be controlling the tech itself.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome back to Regulating AI. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological revolution. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast aims to bring diverse voices to the forefront of AI conversation by featuring insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders to government officials to advocacy group leaders. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Professor Russ Salkudetnau with us today. He's the UPMC Professor of Computer Science in the Machine Learning Department of the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. He also got his PhD at the University of Toronto and worked with Geoffrey Hinton, the Turing Award winner. Welcome, Russ. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Russ, can you give our listeners who are generally members of Congress, Senate, think tanks, their staff, industry leaders around the world, just a very brief idea of what are you doing at Carnegie, especially relating to AI?
Yeah, so I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. I do work in AI, specifically focusing on deep learning algorithms, large-scale optimization. More recently, we've been looking at a topic of large language model, foundation models, but also focusing on AI agents. You can think of these as systems that can potentially make autonomous decisions. You know, think of personal assistants, for example. So that's sort of the spectrum of different research that I'm doing at CMU.
Well, that's a pretty wide portfolio you have, all the hot topics that are going on. Since you talked about the agents, the super agents, Russ, some people think that there is a big risk towards that. What, in your view, are the biggest risks from AI that need to be regulated?
Yeah, so it's definitely very sort of a topic. There's a lot of discussion happening in research communities. So I'm, you know, I have to say that I'm not really sort of that much familiar with regulations and what's happening in that space. But when we think about researchers and what we do, there's certainly a few risks that come up. You know, there are broadly perhaps sort of three different areas or three different risks that I can think of. One which concerns me the most is, you know, the potential spread of disinformation. So the AI technology is becoming pretty good to the point where, you know, we've seen just examples of Sora just coming up out of OpenAI a few days ago, the ability to generate realistic looking videos. And so I think in the near future, it's, you know, spread of misinformation or, you know, trying to do manipulation of your opinion. You know, I can have a system like an AI assistant or an AI agent that convince you of certain things. You know, I've seen these examples where one of the early versions of GPT would actually give pretty good arguments why recycling is bad. And so if you look at the arguments, part of them were fake, but they look very convincing, right? That's probably one of the bigger risks that I see sort of in the shorter term. There's obviously sort of, you know, other risks such as obviously the development of AI in military applications. You know, that's probably inevitable. That's going to happen. And also sort of broader potential, you know, if we look at 10, 20 years from now, is AI going to be replacing some of the labor that's done by humans? And what would it mean for economic development? You know, what would it mean for the economy? So there's a lot of research right now happening in the space, and not just AI, virtual AI agents like ChatGPT, but also in the space of actually physical AI, building physical robots that can do, you know, tasks. And you know, once that sort of takes off, then, you know, there's probably going to be some form of job displacement, right? And that's something that I think my economist friends are thinking about.
Russ, you talked about some very important topics, if I can, you know, follow up a little bit. One is you talked about the disinformation. And and then you talked about obviously the job displacement, and then, you know, a range of those things. As far as disinformation is concerned, and you particularly talked about Sora, which OpenAI released, are we getting to the point where everything is fake and only a few things that we can say with surety and certainty that it is real? People will have to kind of at some point say this is real. Are we getting to that point? That's what is worrying now. The Biden administration's talked about watermarking. They even started talking about using, you know, blockchain technology, etc. Give our listeners, especially this is an election year, not just in the United States, 60 countries are having elections. So as somebody who is an expert in this, what should somebody be believing as far as that information is concerned? So just one topic, and then I'll come to the employment issue.
Very good question. I think that I personally think that we're still a little bit far from actually, you know, having a technology that's so real that you cannot, you know, separate what's real, what's not real. If you look at examples of Sora, there is still missing certain key aspects like object persistency. So, you know, you have a video and then one person would just disappear. But again, those things eventually will get fixed. And I do think that at some point in the future, I don't know when, it's going to be very hard for us to trust what we're seeing online, right? And with deepfakes and everything sort of coming together, like having a really good Photoshop, but not just the images, but the whole video. And somebody in the future, I think you and I would not have this conversation, but our avatars would have this conversation and nobody would just, you know, tell the difference. And so that's obviously, there's a lot of work on, you know, how do we do a watermark? How do we know that what is generated by AI versus what is actually generated by humans or what's real? So obviously there's probably going to have some form of regulation, particularly in the things once it hit consumers. And if I'm a consumer, start generating videos and start manipulating, you know, then obviously that technology will need to be some form of it with consumer sign. When people are using this technology for something else, that needs to be probably have some form of regulation or at least some way of saying that was generated by AI system. And so there's a lot of thinking right now in the research community of figuring out what the solution is going to be here.
So there are some bills already in Congress, Russ, relating to that, and you will have something coming through. The concern obviously is that watermarking is not a 100% foolproof technology. And then I don't know with text to video or text to image, what can you do? I mean, you are the expert. Are there technological innovations? Now you're saying it is still not there, but keep in mind, OpenAI announced Sora, Midjourney immediately said we're going to have something better, and Google's probably going to have something better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that technology is going to be evolving. There is no question about it, right? And so we're not there yet, but eventually we'll get there. I have no doubt. But in terms of, you've asked about image generation, how we can do it. That's a very good question. I don't know. I don't know whether there needs to be some form of system or some form of regulation that would basically say, whatever you generate an image, you're generating an image, either it's a watermark or specific standard that says this thing is generated by AI, just as a way to saying what is something that generated by AI versus what something that's not generated by AI. And we sort of run into this problem right now. There was a very funny example where OpenAI GPT generates text and that text shows up on the web. You know, it's no longer human generated text. It's AI generated text. And there was at one point, if you've seen on X, the platform on Twitter, you know, on the X platform, they have their own assistant called Grok. And there was one point in time where Grok would say, oh, I cannot answer that question, because my OpenAI license doesn't allow me to, or my OpenAI sort of guardrails do not allow me to answer that question. And people started making fun. Why is one platform saying that, you know, I can't give you the answer because OpenAI license agreement doesn't let me? And so what's actually happening is that the text is generated and these other systems take the text from the web because they all crawl the web, they're all getting that information and using that to train their models. And so now at some point, you know, differentiating what was generated by AI versus what was not is going to be, you basically can't tell the difference. And that's something that's potentially, we need to think about what we need to do in this case.
some trial balloons have been floated. Even the administration has talked about the use of blockchain for something like that. As somebody who is working diligently, is that, again, just very briefly, is that a solution here?
I don't know, Sanjay. I haven't really thought about, we're definitely going to have some form of solution going forward, because once we move into the next sort of evolution of these large language models, foundation models, which is going to be agents, we think of them as personal assistant that will do tasks for you. You know, you have an issue with your phone, you just ask your agent, go fix my phone. Or you try to book an appointment with your dentist, you just tell your agent, hey, call my dentist, just book an appointment for me, right? And so we're going to have systems that will make decisions and help you, at which point the use of personal data is going to become very important. The agents will know everything about you, right? Just much like Google and other systems know every time you search on something online, they know exactly what you're trying to do. And at that point, I think that the technology, like you're saying, would it be blockchain or something else, would become very important, because I would want my personal data to be protected. And we kind of moving in that space, I think that's something to think about. And I don't know what the right answer is. But these systems, these AI systems, they're very much data hungry. Right. And so everything that we see today, including Sora and GPT and Gemini, everything is relying on large volumes of data. And so data is sort of probably the most important part of all of these systems. And obviously, when it comes down to using my personal data, that's when, you know, technology like blockchain or something else will need to be developed and need to be ensured that, you know, my data stays private.
Russ, you talked about, and I want to still come to the employment issue, but on the agents, we've had some guests who have raised some serious concerns about some of these agents, super agents, as they said, that they could be out of control or they could be running us, where the humans would become, one of our guests who is a biological ethicist said we would become subservient to the AI system. Is that of fear in your mind at all?
I actually don't think so. It's very hard to extrapolate and see what's going to happen, you know, in 40 years, 50 years. But the way that these systems work today, they're still under the control of humans. So the way that the agents are working today, even though they don't work very well, so that's why it's an active area of research, is where I give my agent a goal, particular goal to achieve. And the agent has to figure out what sort of steps it needs to take to achieve the goal. These agents don't really come up with their own goals. They still sort of, you know, the objectives is something we set up by, objectives are being set up by humans. And so I don't think we'll get to that point where these agents will take over. But I think what will happen in the future is that these agents are going to be so useful to us that we're going to be heavily relying on them to sort of help us with daily tasks. And then there is sort of a fine line as to how much you rely on something versus how much you start thinking for yourself, right? So at some point, you know, once we hit that gray area, then we'll have to start thinking fairly carefully, like, what do we do in this case? Much like today, you know, when I drive and I'm trying to go somewhere, I don't even think how to get there. I just use Google or Apple to tell me how to get there. And if Google tells me to go around and make two circles before I get there, I'll do that.
That's true.
There's obviously concerns sort of going forward that as that technology matures and you're going to start relying on it more and more. And that's sort of one of the problems. And this is, again, we come to regulation will need to be addressed is as these systems become better and better, you know, let's say if we take medical domain, doctors, and, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, GPT-4 and I think the next evolution of these agents is going to know so much about, especially if you give it so much data across different patients, they potentially can be better than your family doctor. And I don't rule that out. The issue is that if that ever becomes the case, then doctors will start relying on the tech. And at some point, you know, what's the fine line of me relying on my own decisions versus me relying on what AI is telling. And this is where I think that in these domains, we need some very good regulations because, you know, it's a very sensitive and very sort of area where you can't really make mistakes.
Russ, just one final point on agents, because some of our guests did bring this up. Are agents going to interact with other agents?
Absolutely. I see the future where, you know, I can give you an example, a very simple example where I would like to have an agent. My phone stopped working. I was traveling overseas. My phone stopped working. I'm calling AT&T. I'm spending an hour with the customer support and doing things like rebooting my phone, then checking something. I see the future where I can just ask my agent, you know, figure out why my phone is not working. And this agent is going to call AT&T agent, and AT&T's agent is going to talk to my agent, figure out what's the issue, how we can resolve it, what's the situation. They can't resolve it, they're going to go to the human to resolve. But I do see the future where agents will start communicating with each other to solve, you know, specific objectives that we give them.
You don't see any danger with that?
I do see the danger in the sense that we'll still need to develop systems. And that's part of the research that we are doing in AI community. Systems that can essentially prevent agents from taking dangerous actions or making sort of, you know, there is sort of a fun thing, which is, you know, my phone is not working. Maybe the agent will figure out the best way to fix my phone is to hack AT&T and fix my phone. And if that, obviously, that's the sort of the hypothetical situation, but if I give it an objective, my phone is fixed. And so there obviously needs to be some guardrails that we need to put into these systems. And this is activated research, and it's very hard to do it right now. Such a way that when these agents take actions and make decisions, you know, there's certain safety protocols in place that would basically not allow these agents to do something malicious.
Okay. We address one of the concerns that you had. The other concern you raised was about loss of jobs. There have been all kinds of reports, Russ. You know, you can take the IMF, you take McKinsey, there will be job losses of 30% up to 60%. But a major transformation is underway. That I think everybody agrees. We've had education experts come here also. You're a professor yourself, but people who focus on just this issue, they've talked about reskilling, they've talked about past changes that people always geared towards more. But the people who will end up losing their jobs, if we talk to them, it's always a very hard thing. And when you're talking about numbers like 30 to 60%, and these are white collar jobs, we talk about customer service representatives, you're talking about marketing, you're talking about coding. What are your thoughts on this, Russ?
I spoke to a few people about this, a few fairly smart people that I respect about, you know, what the future might be. It's still uncertain, right? But we have to be prepared for the case that as the AI becomes better and better, there's probably going to be some job displaced. As the AI, physical AI evolves, right? We'll have robots in our homes helping us out, you know, obviously there's going to be some job displaced. I think that, you know, there's always pros and cons. The pros is that technology is going to be evolving and will help people, will empower people. But yes, at the same time, there's going to be some job displacement. And I think that the main issue that, or the main argument that I see from other people is that, look, technology advances are always good because, you know, our society evolves. But if it takes a generation or two generations, then we can adapt. Because we will get education, people can get the skills necessary to adapt. The worry is that if that technology evolves very quickly, within 10 to 20 years, within a single generation, then that becomes problematic, right? Just like exactly like you're saying, you know, are we going to be displacing customer service representatives? There's a lot of which probably will happen. And that's something that's, you know, I don't know how to avoid because, you know, we sort of thought about, if you look, for example, at coding right now, today, a lot of my friends use ChatGPT for coding and, you know, professional coders are still fine because professional coders, they know exactly what you need to do. They have teams of people when they build something, but sort of, you know, other coders, they're becoming more efficient. And as you're becoming more efficient, then as a company, I don't need 10 people. I might as well just have 5 people, right? They can accomplish the job that I need to accomplish. So I'm becoming more efficient. The company becomes more efficient, but then 5 people just lost the job. I don't know what to do in this case. Time will tell. I don't think we're at the state at this point where there's a massive job displacement because of AI, but we have to be prepared if we look at, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now.
But don't you think, Russ, it might be sooner than that? Because, you know, law firms, small number of a company like Duolingo, let a bunch of contractors go. I think Duolingo is in Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
They let a bunch of people go because they said AI, the contractors go because AI could do the job. UPS, now I don't know if AI was the reason, but I can rattle off names of companies that it seems like the trend has started, and obviously there's a political sensitivity of saying certain things. But my concern is, as you said, these programmers, these customer service agents, it's going to be a challenge. Now, obviously, we'll have to figure this out. And I hope that we can figure it out sooner, because I don't think it'll be 10 to 20 years.
That's a fair point that, you know, a lot of like companies like Duolingo, you know, they fire or they let a lot of contractors go because of translation, machine translation, translating from one language to another. And machine translation systems are getting to the point where they're better than humans to do translation. And so there's certain pockets where we see that trend. Yes, I agree. I still think it's, you know, if you're thinking about replacing human resources, or if you're thinking about customer service representatives, we're still not there to the point where AI can just take over the customer service at this point and just completely replace. Because AI right now, it's sort of good, but it can really, it's one of those things. When I was working at Apple, you know, Apple has customer service. They were using AI to help the customer service representatives, but they would never replace the human, just because there's certain sort of these small probability events, sort of rare events where something happens where only human can address the issue, right? And so I agree with you that it's the trend is starting, but I'm not observing like a massive displacement at this point. But I agree with you. I think that's something that needs to be, especially as AI, as these big companies become, you know, using more and more AI, and the job replacement is, it's going to be one of the topics that we have to figure out. I don't know how to, because AI continues to be evolved and there's so much research happening in that space.
So Russ, you just talked about that AI is evolving. One of our guests said AI is like an amoeba. It keeps changing. As you know, we had large language models, then we had multimodal, we have agents, now we have text to video, we have people talking about AGI. How do lawmakers who are not AI experts, they're trying to craft a law based on the facts today, saying, okay, we're going to protect such and such, we're going to put some guardrails. But 6 months down, your research comes up with something, I don't know, AGI or even beyond AGI plus. How do you kind of evolve those regulations? That's the concern that is there on Capitol Hill.
Yes, that's a very good question. The short answer is I don't know. You're right that AI evolves fairly quickly. Once, for example, when Sora came out, I was very impressed. It's like you look at it, it's like, okay, it looks very real. My estimation was that it's going to take us maybe a few years to get to that point. And when I look at the technical aspects of what they've done, the technology is the same. So the technology hasn't changed. What has changed is the ability to consume a lot of data and having the infrastructure to have the assistance, right? And so with the data and GPUs and, you know, computing that we have, we'll see how far we can go. But in terms of the lawmakers and trying to craft the regulations and such, that's a very interesting topic, because on one hand, you don't want to have regulations that can sort of stop the progress, stop the research, right? There's been a few sort of things where people will say, well, let's actually pause the research or like its development. And that would be a bad idea, because other countries, Russia, China, they're going to continue evolving, right? Their AI systems. And so it's important for research to kind of continue, but it is important perhaps for the lawmakers and regulators to try to think about how do we regulate end products. If I'm developing a system that's going to go and become a medical AI assistant, probably there needs to be some regulation in terms of the quality control. Or if I'm going to be using it in self-driving car, there's obviously regulations where I can't just take any model, stick in my car and start driving around because I may have accidents that, you know, we cannot have that. But I think that the best way for the lawmakers and the government is to perhaps be a little bit more embedded into AI community, into the research, and see where the field is moving, how it's progressing. We at CMU have an organization that specifically works with the local governments, with the Pennsylvania in particular. They come and they talk to us. They talk to professors who actually specialize in that field so that we can anticipate a little bit forward of what might happen in the future. Of course, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen in 5 years, but that's the best strategy for the governments and for the lawmakers to somehow perhaps be a little bit more technical and perhaps be a little bit more, or have people who work with the government to be a little bit more involved with industry as well as with universities.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that the government needs to be involved more with academia and industry.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Now, just to take that thing forward, the industry, at least some of the industry, has been all over Capitol Hill. And some of them have said, hey, we want regulations. Are you concerned that that these companies want regulatory capture in some ways so that somebody after them coming in has a real hard time? And also think about it, to build a large language model. Now, obviously, prices have come down, et cetera, but the cost of GPUs, NVIDIA's market cap just touched $2 trillion because all these big guys are buying up GPUs. It's a war to find GPUs right now. So my question is, you know, somebody in a garage in Pittsburgh can't just wake up and say, okay, I want to build a large language model. So are you concerned a little bit about monopoly of the big tech companies, Russ?
Yes, I am. I am concerned about sort of, you know, and this is both on the regulation side and the open source side. I think that we need to make sure that the control of AI doesn't sit within, you know, two or three companies, right? Because if they put the regulations inside that nobody else can do the development of these models, then they essentially going to be controlling the tech itself. And I don't think that's very good. It's not very good for society. It's not very good for future development of these systems, right? Because a lot of times, you know, it used to be that, for example, Google and OpenAI would publish what they're doing in the research. And now it's basically getting to the point it's becoming very closed, right? Nobody knows how they're building these models, what data they're using, and, you know, things of that sort. So I am worried about this. And that's where I think the role of academia and the role of, you know, open source community is going to be fairly important, because part of it is also for us to be able to study these models. The biggest issue that we have right now is that you have these powerful models like Gemini and GPT, and it's for academic community, it's very hard for us to study and understand when do these models fail, how we can build the guardrails, what can we do to improve these models, what kind of data was used to train these models so that we can improve both the quality control and sort of try to build models that are safer, that are more robust and such. And so there is sort of an open source community that's trying to replicate these systems. And of course, the open source is lagging behind, just because it requires a massive amount of compute and, you know, massive resources to build these models. But I think that, you know, open source will catch up. But that is one of my concerns for sure, because I'm doing the work on AI agents. We want to be able to see when they fail. We want to be able to see this is dangerous, we shouldn't do that, or this is, you know, this is where we need to study these models. And if these models are sitting closed form or closed box behind the wall in Google or OpenAI or whoever, these big tech companies, then it's, you know, it's not good for, I think, for us as a society.
Yeah. Fair to assume that you are for open source, because there is a big debate, you know,
I am
closed source, you are for open source.
I right? am definitely for open source. So the thing you have to understand is that when we look at these models like language models like GPT-4 or Sora or Gemini or anything else, is the technology itself, the algorithms, the model architectures, these are pretty well known. we all know what GPT, what architecture is used. It's using transform architecture with, you know, specific. And what's different between these different models is probably the data, curation of the data. OpenAI spent a lot of money, a lot of time curating the data, labeling the data. That's the differentiator. And compute, the ability to train these very large models. So it's not like, you know, OpenAI has a model that nobody knows about and nobody understands what it is and somehow does this magic thing. We all know what it is. It's just a matter of scaling it up and compute. And so for open source, it's not like you're revealing specific secrets. So that's why I think that, and I think that the evolution of open source, again, to the point where we can study these models, we can understand when they fail, we can say, well, it's probably not safe to use this model in these applications because of these reasons. Whereas if only a few companies control it, well, they don't have to be accountable, right? They don't have to be held accountable. They can just deploy it and, well, if it messes up, we'll fix it internally, but nobody knows about it. It's, yeah.
Yeah. So, Russ, you talked about, you know, that OpenAI has taken a lot of data in there and that's how they've been successful. So how do we balance privacy and utility when it comes to data which is used to train AI models?
That's a very good question. I don't know what the right answer is here, right? You know, I can give you an example. Let's say in the medical domain, just coming back to the medical domain, data privacy is really important there, right? I don't want my records to be released and somebody else seeing them. On the other hand, if we want to build AI that truly can actually be better than, potentially be better than doctors, like at least give suggestions to the doctors, it needs a lot of data. And ultimately, in an ideal scenario, AI would see everybody's data, hundreds of millions of people with all different conditions and sort of understand the data. And that would help us going forward, right? But that requires data. And so where's this boundary of AI consuming the data, our private data versus usefulness for society in general? I don't know what the right balance is. That's something that I think that we'll have to think about as a community. Obviously, there are sort of algorithms, something called federated learning or privacy-preserving learning systems that are trying to address this issue where you can use my data, but it's encoded in such a way that it's never revealed to anyone else, right? So the model can still use the data to train itself, to train its AI, but it's sort of not going to be able to identify that's my data. So there's some technologies that people are trying to develop, but it's still, it's a very sensitive topic, right? And there is a lot of people on both sides because we're seeing this example of OpenAI in New York Times, right? We just saw, I think that yesterday, Reddit had a $60 million contract. Google, she says Google used Reddit's data, right? You know, and so this is sort of, data is really one of the most important cornerstones of AI systems today. And so how do we do this balance? That's a very good question. I think it's also the question for the regulators. That's something that economists, you know, social scientists, AI researchers will have to think about and figure out what the right steps should be. And I see in diverse opinions from saying, well, if you're using somebody else's data and you're not crediting, giving it back to the person whose data you've used, that sounds unethical. But that's what a lot of existing systems do. Companies like OpenAI and Google, they just mine all this data and a lot of data is the data that you've provided, right?
Yeah. Data that we provided, we had the head of the Copyright Association here. The perspective is that when you ingest training data, attribution is important to whose data you have. And in some cases, compensation also. Do you agree with that?
I think so. It's always the case that if I work really hard and I've created the data that's useful, you know, obviously there has to be some form of data attribution. And beginning to see that with Reddit and Google. And so it's just that 2-3 years ago, people didn't really think that these models would work so well. And OpenAI showed that they do. But even in cases like Google, for example, right? The way that Google scrapes your data, you can potentially put like something, I think it's called robot.txt.
Robot.txt, yeah.
You can say, I don't want you to scrape my data. And it, you know, Google will say, okay, I'm not going to index it. I'm not going to touch it. You know, perhaps we should have something like that for AI systems as well. Or if an AI system is using my data, there should be data attribution. I fully agree with that view. Some people might not agree, but, and obviously there is sort of, again, as I've pointed, there is this thing where if nobody shares the data, we're not going to have beneficial AI that can benefit to the whole humanity, right? So it's this balance where if I'm happy to contribute my data, knowing that, you know, there's going to be an AI system that will help others, maybe I will contribute my data, right? Without attribution. But I think there should be some laws in place in some forms of, if you're using my data for training these models, obviously there should be a data attribution.
You talked just now that, you know, there should be collaboration. Do you see, what role do you see for interdisciplinary collaboration in fields, you know, whether it's law, ethics, social sciences, others?
I definitely think there should be a lot of collaboration between different fields, because that's the technology that's going to go beyond just machine learning or optimization is what we do. Once it sort of starts reaching out to, you know, if it starts impacting society in general, through the jobs or through assistance or whatever, in whatever way, then I think that we definitely need to have close collaboration with economists, social scientists, with, you know, people who work in ethics. And I know at CMU, for example, even in our machine learning department, we have a few faculty working in fairly different areas. We have a few faculty working in social kind of aspects of AI. We have faculty who just work on foundation models and optimization. We have faculty who work on with economists, and we have people working with health and sort of public health and trying to understand how the technology is going to be deployed. So I think it's important because the technology goes beyond just sort of algorithms, just machine learning, because it's beginning to impact society in general. So I think that it's going to be very important. We haven't gotten to this point yet because we still have machine learning. We have our own conferences. We have our own researchers. We talk to each other. But we don't very frequently go and talk to social scientists or to economists. But I think that will need to change going forward. And I think it's, you know, AI is where it's going right now. It's inevitable for us to start talking to across these different disciplines and try to understand the concerns of other disciplines in that space.
Yeah. Russ, you work on foundation models and agents and things of that nature. Some of our guests have talked that it is very important that we get cultural and language perspectives of beyond the Western world, you know, English as well as Western world, because there is culture, heritage, history, language. How important is that in your view?
I think that's going to be very important. And I think that's already happening now, to the point where you see each region is trying to build its own GPT. So we're seeing this in Europe. We're seeing this in Asia, both in, you know, in the Middle East and also in Asia. You have China has its own efforts. Middle East has its own efforts. Europe has its own efforts. And part of it is because exactly as you're saying, once that technology starts maturing, you obviously need to ingest the cultural values or whatever the norms you have for, you know, for your country or for your, and I think that's going to be very important. And so it's definitely, I'm seeing that right now just because there's a few startups and then a few efforts sort of happens at the region level, not just in the US. And part of it is, you know, there was just for your listeners, there was at some point, there was this joke that happened with GPT-4, which sort of highlights the nature of the culture, where if you ask GPT-4 for a question, it would answer. But if you ask the question and then add to the prompt, I'll tip you with $100, it gives you a much better answer. if you tell that tip you with $10, it gives you a much shorter answer. Sure. And if you don't tip it, it gives you a very concise answer. So this is sort of, you know, people are joking, well, that's just the culture, the tipping culture in the US. And right. Probably it's what it's doing, because what it's doing is actually looking at conversations or looking at the data that people post online. And when we converse online, you know, we sort of say, well, I overtipped this person, or, and, you know, and that's something that the model learns because it's very data centric. And so if you're training your model on a different type of data that reflects the cultural values of, you know, of your country or your region, that's the AI that's, you know, going to have that. I think it's going to be very important. Absolutely.
Russ, you obviously talked about the cultural, et cetera. Do you think global collaboration is important? Because right now you have AI nationalism. Jensen Huang of NVIDIA said every country should have their AI. Everybody is now, it's like the nuclear club. Everybody, if you don't have an LLM, you're not there. But how about collaboration? EU has done the AI Act. US is trying to work right there. China is doing its own thing. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's a very good question. I don't know. As a research scientist, as a researcher, I think collaboration is important. Because the way that, if you look at how this technology evolved, it didn't evolve from Google or OpenAI sort of building that technology and here it is. It came out of decades of research, international research. When we developed neural networks, when we developed deep learning algorithms, then there's something called attention that was developed in Canada, actually. Then the transform architectures came up, which was developed at Google at that time. And so it's sort of a combination of different things that it's very hard to develop AI on your own. And so I think that if we're just going to have AI in the US and close everybody else, we're not going to get that far. And so I think that collaboration is going to be very important. And that's how research right now functions, right? Because the research right now functions as, you know, we have international conferences. We have people doing research in Europe, in Asia, in Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, in the US. I mean, US is obviously dominates, but the research happens broad. It's very much international. And I think that when it comes down to these systems, we're all going to be better off if the same happens across. Now, of course, there are political constraints to that. Obviously, with the US and China tensions, obviously, there's going to be some saying, well, maybe we should not, right? And, you know, in the perfect world, I think we should, but obviously, other things in play that may prevent us from having this collaboration. I do think as the technology evolves and becomes more mature, I think collaboration is going to be very important. Just closing in one ecosystem is, I don't think it's a good idea. But again, I'm coming it from the research perspective and seeing, because again, the technology that we have right now was not developed by a single company or by a single person. Decades of work happening across multiple countries all over the world, sort of developing the tech and publishing the results and open sourcing. And that's how people say, okay, well, that's interesting. If you look at the example of Sora at OpenAI, was not just developed by OpenAI. It's built on a series of research papers that were produced in academia.
So it's all kinds of collaboration is what you're saying.
Very much collaborative. Oh. That's right.
Yeah. And for a transformative technology like this, more and more collaboration is absolutely important. Russ, are there any sectors that you, when you look at it, say, hey, this is where AI going wrong could be dangerous? Is there any sectors?
I don't see that right now. There are certain sectors that are going to be we have to be very careful, like medical domain. I've mentioned that one. We need to be careful there. Obviously, it could have huge benefits, right? Because sometimes, you know, you go to your family doctor, you ask the question, your family doctor, I don't know, and you go on PubMed and start searching. So you can have an AI that can really reduce the misdiagnosis. But, and so I think that they're going to be sensitive, obviously military applications, that's going to be very sensitive in that space as well, obviously, right? Like how do we, especially once we build AI agents that can make decisions, that's going to be the area where we have to sort of be very careful how that technology is deployed. As the technology matures, again, I think I'm hoping that we're going to have some regulations on the deployment side. When we deploy that technology for users, for consumers, we'll probably need some form of quality control to ensure that the technology doesn't just do bad things. But I don't see any sort of areas right now where I could look and say, that's a really bad case of using AI. I mean, I'm an optimist in general with AI. I know some people don't have the same view. But the best thing we can do is, I think, is collaboratively and through open source, as we're building that technology, understand its risks and understand when it fails so that we can build something that's more robust.
Russ, you're an optimist and so are we. But let's just say if AI goes wrong somewhere, let's say in the medical situation, you build an AI system that's been deployed by a physician or something like that. Who should be liable for that? Large language model company, the developer, the deployer, the doctor?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I see the future where doctors are still going to stay. They're not going to be completely replaced by AI, just as primarily for this purpose that you're asking. Doctors will make final decisions, and if they make the wrong decisions, they're going to be liable. I see the future where AI is going to be helping doctors of what they should do or what they should prescribe, but not necessarily make the final decision. Now, of course, there's a gray line because the doctor can say, well, I was misled by AI. But in general, I think that I do want to see the future where people are still in charge of actually making critical decisions, right? And the liability for those decisions is going to lie with humans, not with AI. And of course, there are exceptions to that. You could argue, well, self-driving car. If there is no person, the car drives itself and gets into the accident. Whose fault is this? And in this case, obviously, the fault is going to be with the company who developed that AI because they did not make it safe enough, right? So
yeah.
If AI completely replaces the human, then it's the company that develops the AI, right? They should be held accountable. If it's AI that's helping humans in sort of these critical applications, then I think it's the humans who are going to be responsible because it's a person or a system that makes the final decision. But I do see the future, at least in various aspects, where some jobs are going to be automated, sort of routine jobs, jobs that require very important, like life-death type of a decision, hopefully is going to be still with a human decision maker.
So you think there'll be a human in the loop, and that's where the responsibility should be.
That's how, at least I see that's how we will evolve in the next, 10, 20 years. And then, of course, there's an argument that at some point when AI becomes much, much better than humans, then maybe AI should just make the decision. But that's something that's the regulation. And this is the way the government would really have to come in and say what, because there are arguments on both sides. I've seen arguments in cases like there was a case with AI helping judges make decisions, parole decisions. And AI would say, yes, you should give the parole to this person because based on the historical data, based on all analysis of the last 50 years, this person should get a parole. And the judge would say, no, this person should not get the parole. And then, so there is like arguments on both sides where the judge might be biased as well. The decision might not be the right decision also. And that's a topic where it's very hard for people like me, researchers, to say who should be right or wrong. That's when we really need regulatory at the government level to define what that is.
Well, that's fantastic. Russ, I could go on and asking you for another 3 hours because there's a whole range of things because of your vast background, but appreciate you taking the time. Our audience, as I mentioned, is global and wide variety. Some final thoughts for our audience that you would like to leave behind for them?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of people who are concerned about risks of AI and displacement of jobs. And that's all, we need to really think about this. But I also want to end up on a note that I think there is a lot of potential for AI as well. Huge potential. Think about education. You can transform education. I can have my own personal tutor that will educate me and think about the entire population of the world. Right? I can have a personal teacher that can educate me and I don't have access to good education. Health, I think, is going to have transformative impact. I've seen some examples, some of my friends actually coming to me and saying, I talk to my family doctor. They don't know. Then I start interacting with ChatGPT and it actually gave me much better ideas of what's going on. And then I can go and dig further and actually understand. Right. So obviously in these domains, in finances, in education, in health, we're going to hear a big transformation. So I think we obviously there's a balance that we need to take into account, but I'm very, very optimistic that if we do things right in the right way, the future is going to be, we're just going to continue improving. So it's both of them we have to consider as the technology evolves.
Well, on that optimistic note, Russ, thank you so much for sharing your insights, your experiences with us today. I know our listeners are going to really get some real valuable perspectives from this. And until next time, to our listeners, please stay informed, stay engaged, and remember that diversity of voices is important and AI regulation and innovation is important. Russ, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.